This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On today's show, our first topic we will discuss is rain with our guest Cheryl Kimmy, and our second segment features Jonathan Chester, a wildlife photographer. But first, some natural lee with your news. The Emporia Gazette reports, the United States Geological Survey reported two earthquakes southeast of Harper on Thursday, a 4.4 magnitude earthquake at 1 p.m. and a 3.4 magnitude earthquake at 1:35 p.m. Harper also experienced a 3.8 magnitude earthquake on Tuesday. People across Emporia reported feeling the earthquake, even though Emporia is close to 140 miles from the earthquake epicenter. Gazette readers in Americus, Madison, and even Council Grove reported feeling tremors. USGS representatives ask that if you felt the quake to visit earthquake.usgs.gov/earthquakes/DYFI to complete a did you feel it form. This helps the USGS map the reach of the quake. USGS reports residents felt the quake in Emporia, Wichita, Burlington, and Dodge City. No injuries were reported as a result of the quake, but some buildings in Harper sustained damage. Earthquakes of this magnitude are known to crack walls, dislodge stone, and cause other minor structural damages. The USGS reports an unusually high increase in earthquakes in Kansas. The earthquakes on Thursday pushed the state over 50 earthquakes in 2014. Some say the increase is due to fracking. Fracking is hydraulic fracturing, which is the process of drilling and injecting fluid into the ground at high pressure in order to fracture rocks to release natural gas inside. USGS believes there is evidence that some earthquakes have been triggered or caused by human activities, like fracking. PressDemocrat.com reports, Governor Jerry Brown signed a North Coast lawmakers' bill banning the commercial production of genetically altered salmon. AB 504, authored by Assemblyman Wes Chesboro, Democrat from Arcata, extends the prohibition of spawning or cultivating so-called transgenic salmonids in the Pacific Ocean to all waters of the state. The hatchery production and stocking of such fish also is prohibited. The legislation protects the state's native steelhead trout and salmon populations, Chesboro said. He noted the federal food and drug regulators are reviewing an application by a company, Aqua Bounty Technologies, that seeks to raise genetically altered salmon in the United States. Quote, if these frankenfish were to escape into our waters, they could destroy our native salmonid populations through interbreeding, competition for food, and the introduction of parasites and disease. The only way to ensure this never happens is to ban commercial hatchery production, cultivation, or stocking of transgenic salmonids in California, end quote. That was a quote from Chesboro in a news release. The legislation prohibits research or experimentation for the commercial production of genetically altered salmonids. ThinkProgress.org reports, the fourth largest U.S. oil and gas company revealed Friday that it is leaving the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, amid widespread backlash over the free market lobbying group's effort to undermine clean energy and promote climate change denial. In a letter to its investment manager obtained by National Journal, Occidental Petroleum said it has no plans to continue supporting the group. The company said it determined that there are, quote, other associations at the state level that provide equal or greater value, end quote, than ALEC. It also cited concerns that it would be, quote, presumed to share the positions, end quote, of other ALEC members, like the American Petroleum Institute and the Chamber of Commerce, on climate change and EPA regulations. Occidental's revelation comes just a few days after a number of tech companies announced they would abandon ALEC, an exodus spearheaded by Google chairman Eric Schmidt last week. Schmidt is in an appearance on NPR's The Diane Reams Show, said the company's decision to fund ALEC was an ill-thought-out because the group spreads lies about global warming and therefore endangers the world. Quote, everyone understands climate change is occurring and the people who oppose it are really hurting our children and our grandchildren and making the world a much worse place. And so we should not be aligned with such people. They're just literally lying, end quote, Schmidt said at the time. ALC, with donors that include billionaires Charles and David Koch, has worked to kill renewable energy programs and teach climate denial in schools. Occidental is the first oil company to publicly announce that it is leaving the conservative group. And so I would like to introduce our host today, Craig.
Okay, thank you, naturally. And this is Craig Lubolt, and my guest today during the first segment is Clay Kimmey and Cheryl Kimmey. We're going to be talking about rain barrels and, to some extent, a little bit about rain gardens, since they're somewhat related. Clay lives on a farm in Jefferson County and is a teacher in the Lawrence District at a Montessori school. And his hobby is kind of getting into sustainability. He lived in Colorado for a while and lived off the grid, and here he is working on rain barrels and is putting together a project that his parents are installing at their land. Welcome, Cheryl, Clay.
But first, we're going to break in here and ask for your support, because we are in our fund drive, and we come to you a few times a year to ask for your support. If you value what Eco Radio KC brings to you, then I'd ask you to consider picking up the phone and making that call, 888-931-0901, 888-931-0901. Eco Radio has been on for many years now. It's a long-standing program on KKFI, and we've provided you with a lot of interesting programs over the years. And I'm going to go over a couple of them that we've aired in the past couple months or so in recent history. So on last week's episode, we had an interview with Don Corrigan, author of Environmental Missouri, and Don teaches environmental journalism in Webster University in St. Louis, and it was a very interesting program. We had a few phone calls and really lit things up. Before that, Richard Mabian welcomed back Zach Pastora Sierra Club lobbyist in Kansas with regard to environmental issues. We had a very lively discussion with Jeremy Alderson about fracking in New York prior to that. We also had a report from the Climate March back in I was able to call in from the road as well as John Kerman, trying to bring the here and now to you and create a sense of what's going on in our environment. If you think we've provided a worthwhile service, I'd ask you now to pick up that phone and call 888-931-0901, 888-931-0901. If you donate at the $40 level, you get a year's subscription to Green Ability magazine. Green Ability is a local magazine about environmental issues, and so it kind of dovetails into what we do. If you donate, and these are all on credit card, if you donate at the $90 level, you will be thanked with the brand new KKFI T-shirt, and that is a long sleeve shirt. And it says, for the people of the people. And great, it looks gray, a nice yellow color to it with black lettering. It has our website prominently displayed, so you can help people, direct people to KKFI's website, as well as 90.1 on the dial. If you donate at the $150 level, we will give you the guest DJ certificate, where you could be a guest DJ for 1 hour on any of our music programs. And it's a wonderful way, if you don't want to be a guest DJ, you can give it to a daughter or a husband or someone that you might think might appreciate it. It's a great way to get people excited about community radio. It's a great way. Many of our music DJs started out as guest DJs. I'm thinking of Diana Lynn, who will be on tomorrow morning from 6 to 8. I'm thinking of Artie, and there are many more. If you can't decide between the T-shirt and the guest DJ, at the $200 level, you will get the guest DJ, the T-shirt, and the Green Ability magazine. But we need you to call right now, 888-931-0901. We've got Beth and Jeff anxious to take your call, 888-931-0901. You can also contribute online at kkfi.org, but why not call 888-931-0901? Ask them about the sustaining giving plan so you don't have to give a whole chunk at once, but you just have a small amount deducted against your credit card or your checking account every month. And it is really easy and friendly and a great way to do. 888-931-0901. 888-931-0901.
Okay. And I might mention, too, that Mike mentioned the Green Ability magazine, and related to our topic today, during the August issue, they devoted a substantial part of that to rain barrels and rain gardens. About it involved Lisa and Billy Justice there.
All right.
Clay, let me start with you. Tell me, first of all, how you got involved in the Rain Barrel Project.
Well, Craig, it's a pleasure to be here this evening. Thanks so much for having us on. I got tuned into rain barrels and water catchment in general as I was woofing, which for those of you that aren't aware of woofing, it's willing workers on organic farms, which is a phenomenal opportunity to plug in and play with a lot of people doing a lot of really amazing things all over the continent and all over the globe. If you want to learn from farmers that are working or people that are working in whatever realm it is you're interested in, woofing is a great opportunity. And so while I was woofing on the West Coast, I woofed for a handful of years between the Monterey Bay all the way up to the BC area. And that is where the overarching theme of sustainability really kind of took root for me. And I know the show's on rain barrels and rain gardens. And I just want to clarify that the whole purpose of having rain barrels and rain gardens is ultimately, in my eyes and in many eyes, is water security. And and also on the municipal level, it's about diverting rainwater from the storm drains and all the like. But really what catching rain in a barrel and in a garden is about water security. So it has a long and protracted interest for me, and it's something I'm really passionate about. And having lived in Colorado, where catching any rain of any type is illegal, coming back to the Midwest, where we actually on this project at my folks' house received a grant from the city of Lenexa for doing just that, it's just a real interesting scenario. So that's kind of a brief overview of how I got into rainwater catchment.
Okay, and I know you mentioned Lenexa helps out with the subsidy. Overland Park, I saw on their website, they do the same. What was the reason you mentioned that it's not legal to do in Colorado? What's the reason for that?
What that comes down to, very simply, is downstream water allocation rights. And in much of the western states, as everyone's, I'm sure, all too well aware, the drought has very broad-reaching implications for everyone on this planet, because all of the fields that are laying fallow right now. So those fields that are fallow and a certain portion of the southern state of California depend on water from the Colorado River, and all water that falls in Colorado feeds agriculture across the southern part of this country. And so it's just illegal because of downstream water rights to capture any water whatsoever in Colorado.
Now, it seems intuitively to me, it seems like that would be counterproductive, because if you're capturing it in these catchments, you're not losing a lot of that water to evaporation. Is that correct?
Well, that is correct, but it's more the immediate water surges that are in fact, there is evaporation there, but it's the overall stream flow rates, and the concerns of farmers and people downstream is that if they're not so much concerned, I think, about residential users, more large-scale applications for water catchment. But you're absolutely right. There is keeping the water at the top of the watershed is definitely a good thing.
Okay. And when you start these rain barrels, what's the process? What do you do? How do you design a rain barrel project like that?
So again, I just want to clarify that rain barrels are just one part of the water solution. Water harvesting, which is what I have been studying, which if you aren't familiar with Brad Lancaster's rainwater harvesting books, those are a phenomenal resource, and he has literally written the book on catching and utilizing rainwater. And so rain barrels are, to me, a very small portion of water catchment. That includes catching water, of course, in tanks, but also in the ground and in the landscape. So the first step in doing so is really assessing your site and what do you need, what are your aims, what are your goals for catching water. Why do you want to catch water, and for what purposes are you going to use it? And then once you have a solid grasp on that, then that will help you or help whomever is working to design a system figure out what your needs are and how those can best be met, be that through a rain barrel or be that through bioswales or be that through a rain garden, whatever the case may be. It's really just assessing your needs and wants and assessing the specifics at your site.
Okay. In water catchments, am I correct that would also help reduce or eliminate the amount of what they have to do to treat the water by diverting it from the stormwater runoff?
Right, you're talking about on the municipal level.
Right.
You're absolutely right, and I believe that's why municipalities like Lenexa and Overland Park now are incentivizing their residents to divert this storm water. And so it's in part due to processing.
Okay. And now, one of the things I had read, one of the projects I saw, they said that I think they were estimating they were saving close to $1,000 a year on water, on their water bills. Does that sound feasible?
You know, it absolutely does. Again, that's really going to depend a lot on your site, on your water needs, and on your applications. In the desert southwest, I have installed systems that are the only means that residents have for water for the entire year. So savings of $1,000 and on up, it just is a matter of, again, what you're designing for.
Okay. And now, when I was in Hawaii, that was actually, I think, the first time you'd ever seen rain barrels. But these were really huge ones that people would have. It was for private residences. But besides using the water for lawn and garden and that type of stuff, some of them were used also to supply their drinking water. Is that something that you're doing with these barrels too, or?
You know, that it's a slippery slope getting into rainwater catchment use for domestic purposes, and that's going to vary a lot from not only the state level but also the county and city level. So currently with this project in Lenexa, it's not, though it is very much a consideration in any of the designs that I do, and it can certainly be used for any of the home's water needs with various filtration means.
Okay, and what are some of the designs that you're using?
One of my favorites, easiest to implement, this isn't catching water. It is catching water directly, but it's storing it in the landscape rather than in a poly barrel of some sort. It is swales, which are just simply contour ditches that direct water across the landscape into places where it's desired. So rather than letting the water run off and sheet off as it does in torrential rains, these little swales on contour, the ditches, collect the water and move them. And in the case of this site in Lenexa at the Kimmy Homestead, we are using swales to pull water from all aspects, including neighbors' downspouts, into the property and direct it over towards an orchard where it is infiltrating into the subsoil to water the trees. And it is... So swales are my favorite, easiest. It's a shovel and an A-frame level, and you can go dig swales all day long. Rain barrels are much more expensive, relatively easy to implement solution, and then little ponds and water catchments that hold a more substantial amount in a landscape, too. Those are the three primary methods of storing water.
Ask Cheryl some questions. Tell me about what you're doing, what Clay is doing on your property.
Well, Clay has been our guiding force on all of this. He started several years ago asking us pertinent questions about if we're going to stay there, what our goals are, what our needs are, and he's been guiding us through this whole process. It's been a total shift in approach to life. My lawn was barren. I didn't have time to spend in the yard. I refused to use chemicals. I refused to put in a sprinkler system. I felt that was counterproductive. And so it was a barren landscape. And Clay came back to the area and said, okay, let's fix this. And has guided us through this process. And we now have, I'd say, one of the most beautifully landscaped homes in our subdivision. Yes, we live in a subdivision. And there's no maintenance for me. There's no maintenance for me. It's absolutely incredible, and I love it and take pride in it. And I'm actually spending more time now in the yard before because I have something that I value. And so Clay's been great in guiding us down this path.
Okay. And you said it's a work in progress. I think you mentioned before it's going to take 10 years to do the whole
probably
thing.
We have limited time, so we tackle a little bit more each year and keep growing it and growing it, literally growing, as we grow more food. And already, Clay, we're what? This is year three into this process?
Right.
And it's just been amazing, and it's been amazing pulling the neighbors in and educating those around us, which has been one of Clay's goals from the get-go, is to educate our community.
And how has that been going? Are there neighbors that are starting to do some of the same things? Or?
Yes, they love what we're doing. They love the look of it, and they want to do it. And so Clay has been doing workshops periodically on our property and showing people firsthand what we're doing, how we're doing it, and why we're doing it, so that they can then go home and do it themselves.
Okay. And I think you had mentioned that you have natural swales on your property.
Yes.
Okay.
Clay, you want to address that?
Absolutely. Those swales are what I was just speaking to, and those are, in essence, it's a ditch that is on contour, so I can take water that is on the east side of the lawn and through a northwest-leaning ditch move it across to the west side of the lawn where I want it to go, with minimal fall and minimal work.
Okay. We just had one of our other programmers has a question, and they wanted to know, when you collect water in the swale or pond, how do you control the mosquitoes?
That's a great question, and even with our heavily compacted suburban clay soil, we have these swales filled and they're sheet mulched, filled with old newspapers, the Kansas City Star, after we're done reading it, and makes a nice weed blocker, and then we put any cardboard on top of that, and then there's wood chips. And so all of that carbon acts as a great sponge to soak it up. And so between that carbonaceous material and then just the time, there really isn't that much standing water. And Cheryl would have to speak to that more, being that she lives there. But there hasn't been much standing water in the swales whatsoever.
No.
All right. And so have you had any mosquito problem?
Not
since
really.
Being in the
no.
US?
No okay. more so than any normal, any other time prior to that.
All right.
But I also want to talk about the rain barrels that we utilize and what Clay has installed for our home and how we do the watering.
Okay. How many rain barrels do you have?
Well, let's see. We have two out front and then one large one in the back and then two under the deck, and Clay can give you the dimensions on each of those.
Okay. All right. So, Clay, let me have you tell us about that.
Certainly. So out front, there are two 310-gallon torpedo-style tanks. So basically, it's a really narrow, tall cylinder. So it's unobtrusive in the front profile of the house. I think the base is 47 inches, and then it's about 109 inches tall, somewhere thereabouts anyway. So those are the two rain barrels in the front. And then out back, I believe it is a 1,200-gallon cistern. And then there are also two 330-gallon IBC totes underneath the deck.
Okay. And what do you do, like, to, I don't know, kind of make it attractive to the neighbors?
What? Sure. Cheryl, do you want to speak to that?
No, go ahead.
Oh, well, pretty simply, they're a poly tank. They're just a plastic tank that we primed with a Kills primer, and then we painted it with the exact same paint that the house is painted with. So color-wise, they blend right into the existing background of the house. And then from there, there's various means of concealment if desired, but it's something that some very simple climbing plants can cover a relatively small or large tank in several years.
All right. And I also wanted to mention a couple of things I had read, benefits of rain barrels. It was on the Bridging for the Gap website. And they mentioned one is because of the water infrastructure with all the water pipes and sewer lines aging, and most of them over 60 years, that by reducing the runoff, that's going to extend the life of some of that. And the other factor was the energy use that when you're pumping the water and treating it, they're using a lot of energy. So anything that reduces water consumption is also reducing energy consumption. And Cheryl, is there anything else that you have about yours?
I want to add with the torpedoes in front, Clay set that up so that as we put the landscaping in, we put soaker hoses around everything, and then Clay taught me how to set the timer the beginning of each spring. And the plants are watered automatically from our rain barrels. And okay. I don't have to worry about watering. If it's a dry season, then I can dial up the time, increase the time each morning. Or if it's a wet period, then I can dial back the time. And it's very easy. And I believe you got all of those supplies at Home Depot or local hardware stores. There we go.
And so the soaker hoses would be connected to the rain barrels. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. And just so people have an idea as to what it costs to do something like this, can you give us an estimate? If they do a project like, of course, it's a little bit hard to describe on radio. You showed me your map and stuff. If you do a project like that, approximately what are we looking at in cost to do this, to install it?
Clay, you want to take that one?
I certainly can. Again, Craig, this is going to come back to so much of what your aims and goals are for a project like this. So with a project like we've undertaken, with multiple means and modes of harvesting and storing water, it's going to be a lot more than simply putting a 55-gallon barrel underneath your downspout, which I just want to say, 1 inch of rain on 1,000 square feet is almost 700 gallons of water. So 55 gallons is really not cutting it. And if you do that, make sure you have proper overflow allocated. But it's really, back to your question of cost, anywhere from $50 to a barrel on up to looking at putting in ponds, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars.
And I believe we're about out of time on this segment. I want to thank Cheryl Kimmy and Clay Kimmy. And if you have any questions, and like I said before, there was an article in Green Ability. So if you are interested in this, you might want to take a look at that. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig.
And thank you, Craig.
And I believe we're ready for our another break here?
Yeah, this is Mike Murphy, and I just want to break in here and show your support, and you guys feel free to jump in. We'll ask you to show your support for Community Radio, for Eco Radio KC. I want to give you a little bit of the history of the program. So Bill Claus thought that there was a need for environmental programming on KKFI. We've aired Bioneers for years, and it's a wonderful, wonderful program. But it was nothing, really nothing to do with Kansas City. And we still do air Bioneers, and it's a very popular program. But we thought it would be great to have a local environmental program. So Bill put out the call to local environmentalists, and he asked folks if they were interested in participating in a radio show. Well, there were 32 people that showed up at that first meeting. So there was a strong, strong interest in environmental radio here in Kansas City. And a group of folks, finally settled in, got a regular slot. Originally it was a half hour, and it became an hour program eventually. And it kind of fell into this pattern where there were four hosts, each with a different point of view and perspective. And then for various reasons, all of a sudden, three of them had to move on to other things. And so we were kind of left wondering, do we continue with Eco Radio KC? Do we let it go? And I felt it was such an important program, and I was there when those 32 people showed up at that first meeting. I knew that there was a strong thirst for this kind of programming. I didn't want to let it lie on the floor. So we put out a second call, and that's how we got Craig, and that's how we got Elaine as well. And we had some other folks. We had Rabbi Moti Reber come in for a while, and he concentrated more on his interfaith power and light duties, an interfaith environmental organization. Susan Burnett was also came in, and she also was very involved. But I just felt this was so important. And then we brought in Natural E, and we're so proud to have her here. And I just thought this was so important, and obviously a lot of people did too. The past few times we've reached out asking folks to step up and contribute during our fund drive, we've gotten a pretty good response. So I would like you to pick up that phone right now and make that call, 888-931-0901. 888-931-0901. You can go online at kkfi.org. We would love to hear from you. I was handed a correction. I guess I was mistaken when I said that the sustaining pledges can go against checking and savings accounts. Apparently, that's just for debit and credit cards, and so my apology for that. But it's a great, painless way for you to show your support for community radio. Have a modest amount taken out on a monthly basis that adds up to a substantial contribution over the course of a year, and that really helps us. If you think this program has been valuable for you, I'd ask you now to call 888-931-0901. If you've ever called in And when we opened up the phone lines, I'd ask you to call right now, 888-931-0901. If you've ever heard anything you've liked, if this program has altered your life in some way. I remember the last fund drive, we had a woman call in who was, we aired when Ethan Hughes, a local or regional activist, got arrested for crossing the line at the Bannister Federal Complex because in protest of the 900-something toxins that are being left behind there by the federal government as they move on to a new weapons plant out south. He made such an impassioned, inspiring speech that we had a woman call up and donate a very generous donation. And she said, you have no idea how much you folks have inspired us. My husband and I are both studying to be chaplains, and this is exactly what we want to do. We want to put our money where our mouth is, and we think this is an important thing. And if you haven't been inspired by Eco Radio, I'd ask you now to pick up that phone, 888-931-0901, 888-931-0901. At the $40 level, we'll thank you with the Greenability Magazine subscription. At the $150 level, the guest DJ. And at the $200 level, the guest DJ. No, at the $90 level, At the $90 level, the T-shirt. At the $150 level, the guest DJ. At the $200 level, the guest DJ, the T-shirt, and the subscription to Greenability Magazine. But it's important that you pick up that phone, show your support for community radio, 888-931-0901. Craig, we've had some interesting shows. We've done stuff on population. We've done stuff on air quality. We've done stuff on the Karma Hop, naturally, you did that great thing about ride-sharing.
Jenny O'Brien.
Right.
Yeah.
And out of Lawrence, finding ways to reduce the number of cars on our road. We've done things on mercury and sulfur dioxide and on the weapons plant and so many things. If you think it's a valuable service, I'd ask you to call 888-931-0901. Last week, as we closed out the show, we were able to bring you some speeches from the Harvest the Hope event up in Nebraska. Neil Young and Willie Nelson and folks putting on a benefit on a farmer's land and right in the path of the Keystone XL pipeline. Native Americans at the forefront of that. Native Americans at the forefront of the climate change march. You've heard some of that audio on this station as well. Pick up that phone now, 888-931-0901. KKFI.org is the website, but go right now, call 888-931-0901.
And this, too, that these are the shows that you only get on KKFI, at least in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of any other station that airs this type of programming and devotes an entire show to environment. Mike mentioned population. We had Alan Weissman on, who is an expert on that, and talking. It was a really amazing show that we had that week. I remember one show back in 2013 in the summer where we had Dr. Helen Caldicott from Australia that talked about radiation issues in the environment, and also an activist on that same show from Connecticut. Fighting the nuclear power plants. And these are just shows you won't get anywhere else. They're a wealth of information. And so I would encourage you to call in, call your pledge in, and support community radio.
888-931-0901.
All right. Now on to our next guest. I have Jonathan Chester here. Jonathan is a professional photographer for approximately 30 years, shooting on all seven continents, so he's well-traveled. His specialties are working on exhibitions and wildlife in remote places. He has shot regularly in the Himalaya, the Arctic, and the Antarctica. He is an expert on penguins and polar regions. And teaches digital photography classes. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you.
And I think we'll start out talking about penguins, because that's what I knew about you to start with originally. And if there's time, we'll talk about some of the polar bears.
Great.
About that.
Yeah, a lot of my friends know me as the penguin guy, so that's quite appropriate.
Okay. And tell me how you got into doing this.
Well, as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm not from Kansas City originally. Mm-hmm. A bit further south. In fact, down in Australia, I grew up in Adelaide, the center of the south coast of Australia. And on a couple of offshore islands where I used to spend the summer, there was a little penguin called the little blue penguin these days. And that was my first exposure to these amazing birds. And Australia is, of course, very close to Antarctica, relatively speaking. I mean, the United States looks to the Arctic. Australia looks to Antarctica. And I was a young, adventurous photographer into climbing and mountaineering, and so Antarctica was the next great horizon for me. And I got into going on expeditions down there, sailing there on small ships and yachts, and working on archaeological projects, but I was captivated by the wildlife, and of course the penguins are the archetypal creature of the southern polar regions, and so I have made a career out of photographing penguins all around the world. There are some 18 species. I've probably photographed about 16 or 15 of those species in the wild, but ironically only four species occur in Antarctica, and only two really breed there in the winter, or are the sort of true Antarctic penguins. And so there are a lot of sub-temperate and sub-temperate penguin species as well that you can see at the bottom of South America, Australia, South Africa, and New Zealand. So we don't have penguins in the Northern Hemisphere except for zoos, including our own Kansas City Zoo, but they're amazing to see in the wild.
Okay, and now you mentioned little blue penguins in Australia. And for people who have been to Australia, they probably think of the nickname like I do.
Yes, well, they were commonly called, when I was growing up, fairy penguins, but that's not quite such a useful name these days, and the proper scientific or common name for them is little blue penguins. They're actually the smallest penguin species, and normally penguins have a white chest and a black back, but the little blue penguins have black or blue feathers on their back, and that color shading is called countershading, and it's very interesting how that comes about. It's an ecological refinement which gives them camouflage, because if a penguin's swimming along in the water and there's a predator underneath it, when the predator looks up, it sees the white belly against the sunlight filtering down through the sea, and so it provides some sort of camouflage. And likewise, if the predator's above, looking down on the back of the penguin, the black back blends in with the inky background. So how the little blue penguins ended up with a blue back, I don't know, but that's just one of their specialties.
Okay, and what is the status of the blue penguins as far as... Are they on in the endangered species, a threatened list, or are they a healthy species?
They're not really on the endangered species list as such, but the biggest problem with most of the penguin species that are in the regions where they share their terrain with humans is to do with predators such as or introduced species, cats, rats, dogs, animals that will very easily kill penguins or steal their chicks and eggs. So if we can provide safety for these penguins to breed, then that's a very important thing. But on top of that, losing their food supply. Penguins are filter feeders, and they catch mostly krill, which are the small shrimp-like crustacea that swim in vast swarms in the ocean, particularly in Antarctica, and then small fish. And so as our patterns of fishing and trawling impact the penguin food supply, so the various colonies around the southern Australia, New Zealand, etc., of these temperate penguin species are greatly impacted. And there are, I think, about three or four of the penguin species on the red list of the IUCN endangered species, and then many more at risk. The most At-risk penguins are the Humboldt penguin, the Galapagos penguin, and the yellow-eyed penguin in New Zealand. The Antarctic penguins are in somewhat better shape, but with global warming, which is affecting the Antarctic Peninsula quite dramatically, there is in fact less sea ice in the northern peninsula, and many of the penguins need the ice to catch, the krill breeds underneath the ice, and if there's no ice, there's no krill, and so the food supply is depleted. But ironically, warmer air temperatures can hold more moisture, and so there's been more snowfall recorded on the Antarctic Peninsula, which means that the penguins can't begin nesting as early as they need to. It's a very short summer in Antarctica, and they have a very defined length of time to make their chicks and have them fledge. And so if they spend the first, you know, 3 or 4 weeks sitting around waiting for the snow to melt to get a rocky nest to be able to lay eggs and successfully raise chicks, a lot of these colonies have collapsed, and that species, particularly the Adélie species, are having to move further and further south, and pretty soon they'll run out of room. So there are species in Antarctica which are suffering from global warming. There are winners and losers in different species are adapting better, and some are losing out. But overall, the impact of global warming in Antarctica is quite dramatic.
And what are the species that are in the Antarctic?
Well, the true Antarctic penguins are the emperor penguins and the Adélie penguins, but on the peninsula we also have the Gentoo penguins and the Chinstrap penguins, which breed in large numbers in various colonies, particularly also on the sub-Antarctic islands. And then as you get further north in places like South Georgia, the Falkland Islands, and a lot of other sub-Antarctic islands, we have that other magnificent penguin, the king penguin, which we have examples of in Kansas City at the zoo. And the emperor penguin and the king penguins are the two largest ones, which stand about sort of hip or thigh high, depending on your height. They're 39, 40 inches tall, and they are certainly a magnificent bird.
And in terms of which ones are declining, I think Galapagos penguins are one of the worst ones,
yes,
as far as decline?
Yes, the Galapagos penguins are very susceptible to changes in the food supply, which is affected by things like El Nino, and also fishing in the areas around the Galapagos. It's quite a small population. And also the Humboldt penguin has suffered serious declines because they breed in tunnels, and they used to have big mounds of guano on the offshore islands, and these were mined for fertilizer in the 20s and 30s, and so they lost a lot of their habitat for breeding, and they're also caught in fishing nets, etc., etc. So wherever humans and penguins overlap in their ranges, then it puts stress on penguin populations.
Okay, so for at least most of the, do you call them species or breeds of penguins?
Well, there are 18 different species of penguins.
Okay, so for most of them, it's a matter of human contact that's contributing to the decline.
And particularly
and global
also
warming.
Well, that and global warming. I mean, the human contact from predators and from oil spills. Oil spills are another very big problem. If the birds get oil on their feathers, and then when they're preening, they ingest the oil, and then they get hypothermia or die from having oil in their system. And so big oil spills in South Africa, in South Atlantic, and heaven forbid in Antarctica, would be disastrous for penguin populations. But the global warming is the biggest issue for penguin species, and particularly the Arctic species as well, of course, the polar bears, because without the sea ice, their food supply in the Arctic, which is the seals, is gradually going away. And so polar bears are in fact changing their diet to trying to survive scavenging for eggs and things like that from ducks and other creatures that have big nesting flocks in the Arctic islands.
And what is being done to reverse that or protect the habitat? I know we have, I don't know if our law covers any of it, the Endangered Species Act.
Well, the most of the work that I do in Antarctica is through adventure travel trips, and I'm an expedition leader for One Ocean Expeditions, and we take up to 100 people a time, and we work under the guidelines laid down by the International Association of Antarctic Tour Operators, and it's a self-governing organization where we have an idea of trying to minimize our impact. We only allow sort of one ship at any one landing site at a time, and usually we'll visit one place in the morning and one in the afternoon. And so we have a schedule that we prearrange so that we're not putting too much pressure on any one place. And then we have got very well-trained naturalists, and of course the photographers are the worst ones. They're always trying to get closest to the wildlife, but penguins have no fear of humans on land, and so basically the best way to observe these incredible birds is to sit down and then get very low down to the sort of eye level almost, and they will, if they're relaxed, come very close to you. So you don't need a huge telephoto lens, and you don't need to invade their space. But by managing tourist visits to Antarctica very carefully, we can give people a chance to experience some of the most amazing wildlife in the world in a very ecologically responsible way.
All right. And unfortunately, we're out of time. But hopefully you'll be able to come back sometime and we'll explore this some more and get into the polar bear some more.
I'd love to do that. And it's great to be able to talk about a part of the world or parts of the world, the Arctic and the Antarctic, that are very special to me. And that even here in Kansas City, we have people who are working hard to understand the issues of global warming. Particularly at KU, we have the Center for Remote Sensing of Ice Sheets right here in the center of the country.
And back to Mike Murphy.
All right. Actually, we're going to hear from Cheryl Kimmy.
Hello, this is Cheryl Kimmy of the KC Fringe Festival, asking you to support KKFI, your community radio station, where you hear radio like you've never heard it before. KKFI provides a vital service to the performing arts community in Kansas City. KKFI covers the performing arts like no other radio station, whether it's the Blues and Jazz Calendar, This Week on Stage Theater Calendar, Arts Magazine Show on Mondays, or Anything Goes on Fridays, or whether it's helping us at KC Fringe promote our annual July Festival. KKFI informs its listeners about the rich variety of performing arts here in our community. And that's what community radio is all about. If you want entertainment and information that you cannot get anywhere else, if you share KKFI's mission, then call 888-931-0901 and make your pledge today. That's 888-931-0901. Or if you'd prefer, go online to kkfi.org and make your pledge. Call now, 888-931-0901.
And thank you, Cheryl. Cheryl was our guest in our first half of the program, and so it was good to hear her make that case for supporting community radio. Her pitch there was she was wearing her fringe hat for that particular piece. Think about all the great public affairs programs we have on. We have Radioactive Magazine, another program initiated by Bill Claus with local activists, not just environmentalists, all sorts of causes and organizations being represented on that program. That's on Tuesday evening. And we have the Heartland Labor Forum on Thursday evening. We have Jaws of Justice on Monday morning after Democracy Now! We've got Tell Somebody on Thursday morning. We've got great, we've got the forum, the All Souls Forum. So many great, opportunities for issues to be discussed of both local and national important. And I always feel that KKFI is at its best when it connects the local with the global. Just as this last segment we just heard, that's exactly what that was about, is local folks here on the ground in Kansas City working on stuff in the Antarctic. And so that's, I really am proud when I hear that kind of stuff, because that's, I think, when we shine, when we connect what's happening here to the large, big world picture. If you think that's an important thing, I'd ask you to pick up that phone now, 888-931-0901. We need to get a couple of phones ringing before we get out of here. Again, that number is 888 888- 931-0901. You can go online as well at kkfi.org, but why not call 888-931-0901. And now the calendar.
Thank you, Mike. This is Natural Lee with your events coming up. On Saturday, October 18th, from 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. at City Hall in Columbia, Missouri, they're having the Sustainable Building Tours with workshops, great booths, and displays at no cost. The 2014 Sustainable Living Fair is the place to be if you want to learn how to reduce your footprint and live a more harmonious, sustainable lifestyle. From passive solar building to gardening to bike maintenance and much more, there's something here for everyone. Again, that's at the City Hall in Columbia, Saturday, October 18th. Tomorrow at 6 p.m. on Radioactive Magazine, they will be discussing eco-literacy, and that's here on 90.1 KKFI. And the USGBC Central Plains Chapter and the Kansas City Energy Project are hosting a one-hour workshop on building energy audits. This workshop will provide attendees with the critical elements needed to assess a building's performance. It will answer the question, what do I do now that I have benchmarked my building? Led by expert Dustin Schaefer, Vice President in charge of technical standards for Henderson Engineers, Schaefer will explain the industry standard definitions of commercial-grade energy audits and focus specifically on describing the different offerings available at each level of service. The workshop will be held Tuesday, October 7th at 8:30 to 10 a.m., and it will be held at the Anita Gorman Discovery Center at 4750 Troost. You can RSVP by sending an email to schopp@kcchamber.com, and for more information, visit our Eco Radio KC Facebook page. And the last event we have is the Soil and Soil Amendments. This takes place October 7th, 2014 at 6 p.m. Kansas City Community Gardens hosts Soil and Soil Amendments. The condition and health of your garden soil is a major factor in the success of your garden. Learn how to determine your soil's condition and how to use soil amendments to increase the harvest from your garden. The event will be held at the Rosedale Development Association at 1403 Southwest Boulevard. You can call 931-3877 to register. That's the 816 area code. And for more information, visit Kansas City Community Gardens online.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.